Hello, this is the Business Marketing Club podcast for B2B marketing people who want to get on and stay ahead. In each episode, we'll be offering insight and inspiration on a key current topic, advice on how to climb the career ladder, and top networking tips. I'm Dave Stevens. I'm a B2B marketer, and I'm chair and co-founder of the Business Marketing Club Community Network. In this episode, I'll be speaking to Ali Richards, the CEO of Adisiant, and to Jonathan Kam, Global CRM Director at Namecheap, about how to really sweat your content. Plus, Head of Business and Industry Marketing at Panasonic Business Europe, Rachel Hind-Harris, will share some great B2B marketing examples and what she's learned from them. And Louis Fernandez shares a key lesson that he's taken on the journey to being MD of HRS Group for Northern Europe. Lots of great content then, so let's cut to the chase. You're only as good as your marketing content, because it's your content that needs to balance a consumer's intent with the objectives of your business. But how do you get that balance right? I'm joined by CEO of Adisiant, Ali Richards, to tell us. Ali, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Dave. Firstly, thanks for having me on your podcast.
It's great to have you here. But you should tell us right off about Adisiant. What is it? What does it do?
Well, firstly, I like that you mentioned that content needs to balance consumers' intent with business objectives, because that is what is at the core of Adisiant. That's what we're about. Adisiant is a software platform that allows businesses to design and map their buyers' journeys. Within that, to understand that the content is supporting the buying process, not the sales process. So once content is audited against the buyer map, businesses can then use Adisiant to both manage the production of missing content, publish it to multiple channels, and most importantly, monitor its performance end to end. So our approach means that businesses using Adisiant would have a full marketing attribution to sale. So that's really important. You will also notice that I say buying journey. It's not customer journey. So customer journeys tend to mean processes and your processes for taking a customer and onboarding them stuff. And that's not what we do, although that's part of it. The buyer journey is kind of bigger than that. It starts with the person's needs and how you go about fulfilling them.
Okay.
So that's the kind of the difference between those. And then to answer your other question about how to get the balance right, because of the, you kind of had two questions in there.
Yes.
And that was to, when the buyer maps are in place, it's possible to audit the content you have against the buyer map to make sure you're meeting the needs and fully meeting those needs as they progress through the journey towards a sale. And by creating a body of content that supports all the needs of your personas and various personas you might have, and then you make sure you connect the content together so it is a journey. So you don't just have disparate bits of content. That's what businesses, organizations that sell B2C as well tend to do. They just have standalone campaigns or standalone blogs. We're about making sure you connect these things together so it creates a journey. You don't have dead ends. You don't just leave a person hanging there midway through the conversation, so to speak. So connecting content is vital. And too often, businesses just create standalone items. So they have an idea for a piece of content, create it, publish it, and then it goes nowhere. It just creates dead ends. But the content is connected, and it does support the buyer's needs. That then creates the balance, back to the question, because that balances the buyer's needs and your commercial goals. So, and then there's obviously, by the way, two things that it does by doing that. You can easily identify when you've got a marketing qualified lead, when you decide that that is, and you've got the attribution to sale because you track the journey rather than the funnels or individual funnels.
So you talk there, and also actually you've written a paper on this, and you talk in your paper about the importance of mapping that buyer journey. How do you go about that?
Okay, we have a template project. We have templates for everything, actually, that takes a company through 8 steps. And it's important to note that the template gets tailored by how mature a company is in doing certain things. So we start off with personas, but the personas that we do are not perhaps what you're used to doing. We don't have personas as shelfware. We don't create pretty portraits, pen portraits that then nobody uses, because we're very, very interested in the needs. And we align those needs to the value proposition. So I've seen you've been doing a series on value proposition with Malcolm.
Yes.
And so what we do is look at the needs in 4 dimensions, which is emotional, social, supporting, and functional. And then we look to say, right, how does that value proposition align to that to make sure that the value proposition you've created is properly aligning to personas? That's the thing to do. Then we look at 3 is channel strategy. So you're looking at how the content is distributed. So we start from a content first point of view, then how do you distribute it? And the reason for doing that is then you get rid of silos, because it's so often we've seen, and I'm sure you've seen it, that you've got a team that does social media, a team that does campaigns, a team that does above the line branding and other stuff. And they all create their own content, and they can therefore create lots of different experiences for customer because of that. But if you put content in the middle and then work out you distributing and publishing, it's much easier to create a unified experience from that. 4 is buyer journey maps, which is where we actually build the maps. 5 is editorial planning. And this is perhaps something that is a bit new to businesses, which is where we say you need a much more journalistic approach to creating content, and you need to improve the quality of the content that you create now in particular. And we audit the content against the map so that you've got a gap analysis of your existing content and where it supports the journey, so that you can then set out new processes for production of content. As we said, bringing content to the middle, which also means bringing the production processes to the middle and improving those. An editorial essentially means cadence and how often you're creating things and publishing things. And it's about setting that from an organization point of view in place as well. We then look at activation. So what's your marketecture? What technology have you already got in place? Because we don't replace your campaign management systems. We don't replace your CRM systems, none of that. We integrate with those things. But that's also where your silos can turn up. So we want to get rid of those and try and make sure that you don't have lots of different places where messaging is going on. Then we put in measurement, and finally optimization, because every item of content has a context of where it sits in a journey. We can optimize how well content pushes somebody through a journey. So you're creating content with a much different purpose than you might be if you don't have buyer journey maps, because each item of content has a job to move the customer to the next place.
And if you do put content in the center of everything, how do you articulate the role of that content in each of the steps of the journey?
Okay, so the role of content is always twofold. Answer the needs for the buyer for where they are and where they are on the journey, and then move them forward in the journey. It's as simple as that, just two things, that's it. Now that might sound simplistic, but if you look at each item of content in its context of the map, you will see that you create a very specific brief when you're doing the briefing process of content. And to be fair, you have to see content that it actually does this. Your content creators may not be used to doing this, so you have to brief them in that process as well. And to date, content has mostly been created standalone. And even if we create it in the context of a campaign, we still might only create a few steps in looking at funnels and things where we do multi-stage campaigns. And this is bigger than that, because we're not doing standalone pieces. The content is about helping us to have sustained engagement. So anyone can join at any time, anywhere, and they can skip around in the journey. And you have a body of content that supports a journey that's always live.
So what sort of business outcome can I expect from going through this process?
Okay. So firstly, reduced lead loss. So as I've talked there about the idea of somebody going through the journey, they can join anywhere, they can leave anywhere. We basically lose the idea of a funnel, which loses people all the way down, so that you've perhaps only got 5% coming out the other end from the 100% that you had at the top. So we reduce that because we create a better frictionless customer experience to buying, so that you will be significantly smoother in having your buyer journeys in place, and buying resistance will be more easily managed. So we can increase lead generation and conversion rates because you can look at how the journey supports the end-to-end, you know, from the point where they join the journey to the end, because you can measure each of those points. You can see what can be optimized, and therefore the conversion rate improves as you do that. And you aren't losing anyone through the funnel, so you've got greater volume and a higher conversion rate. The wider business benefits are around business alignment. So beyond marketing, it's getting the whole business aligned to the idea of the whole journey. So this requires a bit more work in terms of, you know, internally communicating what the buyer journey is. So it means marketing has got to talk to sales and understand. So yes, and I know, shock horror, and actually take, and you know, when one of the things that we found so often is sales complain about the leads they get not being qualified. Now, how would they feel if they got a lead that said, right, this is the needs this person is interested in, they've got this far, they've done it this quickly, this is where they're at so far on the journey? That's not just we're saying the lead's qualified, we're proving it to sales. We're saying this is what this person's been doing because we can see all their activity. And why that's important is that when it comes to content, we don't read or watch what we're not interested in. So if you're reading about a particular need and we've structured that into the content, we know that interests you. That's self-qualifying then, and creates that need information that we can pass into CRM systems to sales.
So this all sounds great, but it also sounds a bit theoretical. So I wonder if you can perhaps give us maybe a real life example of where this approach has worked out.
Okay, so yes, I can. At a very large UK bank that I can't name, we did implement Odyssean. And the focus of the implementation was for an asset finance product, which was sold to businesses whose turnover was over 5 million. So not the consumer bank, definitely the B2B part. And the goal was to generate leads for relationship managers, essentially the sales team. Now, before the start of the project, the bank was not doing much in the way of marketing, shall we say, and not necessarily generating leads. So the benchmark wasn't exactly a big stretch for us to improve on that. But at the same time, is when we look at the numbers, which I'll discuss in a minute, it was significant. And so there was more problems that were systemic that we were looking at how the content could change things. So for example, contact with customers was at most once a year. But that might have been even less than that, because a relationship manager could have between 50 customers or 100 customers they looked after, and they might only get to 20 or 30 of them throughout the year. So a lot of customers went more than a year without any contact from the bank at all. So as you can see, probably bigger issues than perhaps just the content that the content was trying to address. So what we were trying to do was get a consistent flow of leads created on a monthly basis, that they were qualified, that they identified the needs. And by the way, for asset finance, we identified 198 different needs that customers could have. Now, asset finance is quite a generic product set. And so when it came to mapping it, we had to split it down by the sorts of things that you would buy with it. So, you know, doing the buyer journey said, you know, that we found that you could, there was a good split between anything with four wheels, so vehicles, and other big stuff. So the asset finance was for things like manufacturing equipment. In agriculture, it's for combine harvesters, and you know, it can be for production line stuff. It can be for actually for big IT as well. So it covers a lot of stuff, which is why there's so many needs that you need to create. So we wanted to create it to create ongoing sustained engagement. In other words, always on. Now, what we did with them is a monthly newsletter. Now, that's not necessarily something we would necessarily advise, but for them, it was a big shift from once a year to once a month of actually reaching out to people. And what we did is we dropped in three articles per newsletter that had some needs that we might see that they engage with. And then every month you got different people engaging with different needs that led them forward on the journey. So they went from an email into a content hub where we progressed them on a journey. They got deep insights in the needs by persona, and they got that at an individual account level. They got insight into buying, rollover, loyalty, the customer's behavior that wasn't possible before, because you can't, because asset finance isn't like a bank account. You don't see the transactions to see behavior. You just sort of see roll off and roll on and whether they're doing it or not. But this gave us a lot, that gave the bank a lot more information about that. And so finally, from a zero start point, if you like, within 6 months, we generated 400 leads, marketing qualified, which to a lot of businesses, that doesn't sound like a lot. But if you go from zero to that, and the other thing is that those were really big deals. So, you know, we weren't, they weren't selling small stuff. One of the deals that came out of that was for marine, and it for, well, it was for a shipping, a ship that held shipping containers. You know, so really, really big stuff. So, you know, we could have made the ROI on this, this work with just that one deal.
Just that one, yeah.
Yeah. So it's very difficult to compare it to other businesses, but it's also shows how immature they were, that even by doing something quite small towards understanding and engaging with customers with content made a massive difference.
Ali Richards, CEO of Adisiant, thank you very much.
You're most welcome.
My next guest is Jonathan Kan, Global CRM Director at Namecheap. Jonathan, welcome to the podcast.
Hi.
So tell us a bit about Namecheap, first of all.
Okay. Namecheap is a global supplier of domains, hosting, and security. I like to describe it as it sells everything a customer needs to build a website. It's probably the best way to describe it.
Okay. And that must give you a pretty good perspective then on content. So what's the role of content in B2B marketing today, would you say?
Content is provides differentiation between suppliers of domains. For example, if you go and try and buy a domain, put domain, or want to buy a domain in a search engine, you'll get 20, 30, 40 suppliers selling exactly the same product. The only major differentiator is price. So one will be $8.99, the other will be $5.99. So how do you differentiate your company from the rest? One area that we do is customer service, which we're exceptionally good at. But the other one is, how do we provide the ability for the customer to build on that? We know 40% of our customers buy a domain with an idea and then leave because they don't actually do anything with it. Their dream doesn't come true, or their business doesn't come true. Provides us with a great opportunity to actually help them, not just sell to them. We all know 50% off, 20% off, it gets boring in the market. So how do you provide that content to provide, to enable that person to, how do I build a website? What do I need to look at? How can I secure my website? All of this information is incredibly valuable. And I think that is the major difference to where we were about 3-4 years ago, is we're now starting to provide content, and that is cutting through specifically actually in the last 4 months, when obviously people started to work from home, people are starting to look at how do I make my idea, how do I take my business from a retail front end to a e-commerce site. All of this information, people are exceptionally interested in that sort of content. The major difference is we have to provide content that people can trust, not too biased, actually right from the heart. And it provides also a massive differentiation and brand building exercise if you can be the trusted supplier. So we've done exceptionally well, not only with driving engagement, and i.e. that's coming to people to read our information. And we've seen that just from the metrics. I think 50 to 60% up are just on reading our blog, to actually the sales that are related to that. So that is the area that we've been concentrating on. One of the areas we've been concentrating on in the last 2 years is that content driven to the customer, for the customer.
And from the way that you described that, I'm kind of guessing that you would concur with Ali Richards' approach to managing content directly against each step of the buying journey.
I think that's Ali Richards is got a really, and I'm not going to turn into an advert for Ali's work, but
she's on the podcast as well, so she'll already be advertising herself, I suspect.
So her concept is really interesting, mainly because it provides what I like to see as the customer's chapters, is that, as you said, a customer's buying journey. How do you provide that information to create the dream, to move from the dream to actually build the infrastructure? From the infrastructure, then where do you go from an infrastructure, which I can build a website? How do I get money to come to my website? How do I make my website more interesting? More people come to my website. All of this information is not about the bits and bobs that build the website. It's about how to use it. Ali's got a really interesting element of making it automated, a lot of the back end, which is really interesting. We're much more manual than that, because we're in that evolution of moving towards that stage. And so at the moment, we are looking at, to the point, we're just looking at the content that cuts through. We do the research, we build the content, does it cut through? Then how do we provide the next bit of content? And that's what we're working on at the moment. Can we automate? So a customer reads item A, can we automate them when we, knowing who that customer is, you push them item B or C. So you do next best bit of content. So we actually can keep them engaged ongoing through our eco structure. So that's the element we're looking at doing. So yes, I do buy into what Ali's saying. The bit that I think our biggest challenge here is how do you relate that directly to sales, which is an interesting question which we are looking into at the moment.
And where, what's your view right now?
My view right now is it does, but we have to look at change of customer behavior rather than instant sale, because we started off with something called story design. And I don't claim this. One of my team members created the idea of story design. It's where you create a story. You move from chapter to chapter back to the hub of where the content is. So it's not just one piece. You go from, as I said, piece A to piece B to piece C. That was all directly related to the promotion we were running. So, for example, we ran a small business week. So all our content was around small business, how you set it up, the ideas, profit and loss, all of that side of things. That's not, again, not related directly to the domains, but it's providing that little bit of color to who we are. But what we couldn't do is relate it directly to that promotion, because the sales of the promotion weren't doing. We took a step back and then said, really, actually what we're providing is content, and a customer maybe not driven by the promotion, but they come to us when they want the product rather than when the promotion is running. And this is a change of view, change of culture, is actually our customers will buy when they want to buy. Our promotions don't normally drive their sales. We know this from research. So if we can become in front of mind, then when they do need that next bit of security, that next bit of e-commerce infrastructure, that they can come to us.
So let's go back to basics. If people are looking to take this approach with their content themselves, you've got to start by knowing what your customer journey is. So how do you go about researching that journey?
firstly, know who your customer is. That's probably a critical point. Then you go and work out who your journey is from there. We have an interesting area because I call it, we're in the gray market. So we provide to consumers as well as business. We provide to the hobbyist, the hobbyist in the garage who's writing a website on trains, for example, versus the web professional who's making multiple websites for multiple clients. So we cross over the divide. So firstly, know who your customer is, then divide, then look at their customer needs analysis, all of that. Great buzzwords, but understand where they go. What do they do first? What do they do second? What are they looking for? Who do they get influence from? And then talk to them about what their pain points are. Where do they need help? You can also do that by just looking, creating content, give it a go and see what cuts through. We know, for example, security is a massive issue and people gobble up content based on that. SEO. I built this wonderful website, wonderful, but how do I get people to it? A huge piece. Not many people know about it. Again, immediately, suddenly see an opportunity there. We can produce information. WordPress, Gutenberg, all of these things I won't get into a huge amount of detail on, but it's a common theme that we know cuts through. So yes, the customer journey. How do I move a customer down the funnel to buy? But also how do I, in the end, they're not really worried about that. I want to move that customer from dream to build a website, from build a website to actually make money through the website. And then once they get to that point, they might even build other websites for other people. Hmm. So you actually move them down that maturity level, which is a different funnel, I suppose.
And there'll be presumably different business outcomes at different stages of that customer journey too.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, again, all the major metrics. Sales is the big one for us. We are driven by the numbers, as a lot of companies are. With at that size, that still that daily, monthly figures are vitally important. So we're driven by numbers, but we're also driven by retention, customer service, all the great metrics. What's the interesting element is, can we relate the story or the group of stories to that metric? That's the challenge, as I said earlier on. We haven't conquered that yet, because then that justifies the amount of effort and time we put into this. That's the interesting one. How do I link my blog, which I know now has a million views in the last 6 months, which is amazing, to money? That's the interesting, that's the ROI, that's the challenge. At the moment, there's a faith, there's an understanding that content, people coming to our infrastructure, coming to our place, actually drives traffic, therefore drives sales. But what I want to do is do an actual link between the two. That's the bit I would say I need help on, because I don't actually know how to do it yet. And so you read up on it and try and do it. But the key to it, if going back to how did somebody start, just start writing. Speak to your customers. What are they interested in? Look at that journey. Where do they go to? Find what the journey is for a start. Are you trying to drive sales? Are you trying to drive engagement? Are you trying to drive retention? What are you trying to do? Plot that out. Start writing. See what cuts through. The key to it is not overthink it. Just get on and do it.
Great advice. And by the way, when you can make the link between your blog and sales, you'll come back, won't you?
Yes,
come back and tell us what it is.
I'll write a book about that.
Jonathan Kang, Global CRM Director at Namecheap. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
There's some great B2B marketing out there. And I'm joined now by Head of Business and Industry Marketing at Panasonic Business Europe, Rachel Hind-Harris, to look at some of it. Rachel, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me. It's good to be here.
So some great B2B marketing out there. What's caught your eye?
Do you know what? One of the things that's been hardest hit has actually been recruitment. And one of the things that struck me is actually Hays recruitment and how they've pivoted. So they always publish research every year about recruitment sentiment and, especially in the marketing arena. Mm. But what they've done is they've taken it a step further. So they've actually been organizing in small groups, networking round tables, with their MD talking to people, and yes, I've been on one, talking to senior level marketeers about their research, but also they are able to get closer to their potential customers and potential clients. And that value exchange has just increased dramatically because they're getting that personal touch. But in addition, they've also supported that with opening up their Hayes Learning Portal, which is a free tool. And I guess you could almost equate it to a bit of a, like a LinkedIn Learning. So there's lots of free courses in there for multiple disciplines. And they've made that available. So while they're not necessarily actively recruiting, what they're doing is keeping those relationships going. And I think that's been a really, really interesting way of doing it.
There's a lot to potentially impress you there, because there's the fact that actually they are still marketing at a time when arguably for them, there's less, well, there's certainly less immediate value. Then there's the kind of personal approach they've taken in their events. Yeah. Then there's the fact that they're marketing on a couple of different fronts. But what is it that impresses you most?
What impresses me the most is the way they've taken their core skills. So they deal with people day in and day out, be it mainly on recruitment, understanding people's skills and selling into their clients and vice versa. But what they've done is they've taken that knowledge and they've used their network and they've create giving something back to their customer base without any expectation of return in the near term. It's all about building that relationship and that foundation so that as we come out of this, and we will come out of it one way or another, we're already starting to, they are in a position where they will be front of mind, where people will be more familiar with their brand and more comfortable dealing with their staff because they've already built the relationships prior to starting conversations about job roles.
And there's lots of research, I think, to say that the thing that you absolutely must not do in a time of downturn, stroke crisis, stroke economic collapse, is to stop marketing, right?
Exactly. And one of the things that they're definitely hearing, and they've been using it to reassure marketeers, because obviously that's my field, but to say, you know, the value of the marketeer has increased. And you're now getting a seat at the top of the table. And while there are fewer jobs, they're saying out there, it's reassuring because they're looking for people with experience and people with value, and you get a seat at the table. So on the one hand, they're giving you research about the state of the market and giving you training tools so you can use the time to do self-development. And then on the other, they're giving you reassurance as well to say, if not that I'm looking for a role, just to get that in there in case my management team's watching.
you can expect a flood of emails after this podcast has dropped.
They're giving a reassurance to any would-be candidates out there to say it's not the end of the world and things are moving and actually you're more valued now in your discipline.
And what would you say from a marketing perspective you've learned from this that you'll apply to future work?
The trust and authenticity has always been key, and I think they're crucial brand elements that have never been ignored, but how they have been articulated and demonstrated during the time of the pandemic has been something that's elevated. So there's, at the start, there were lots of people talking about on LinkedIn and social platforms about how they were supporting the NHS, how they were changing, like the Formula One teams, changing their R&D teams to create parts and ventilators. Panasonic themselves, the Cardiff team, the factory we have there, they were using their 3D printers to print PPE for the local hospital in Cardiff. So there's been a lot of that we're supporting in a crisis message out there. And I think that those brands that have been doing that have built a reputation of being not just about the making the money, they're actually supporting the wider environment and the wider community. So I think in terms of moving forward, that authenticity and trust needs to come out in the communications a lot more than it did before. Whereas before it said, oh, we can save you time and increase efficiency. It's more about the why and the so what that comes with that, and the face of the company. So, and your trusted advisors talking on your behalf, I think, will come more strongly.
Rachel Hind-Harris, Head of Business and Industry Marketing at Panasonic Business Europe. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next up, Louis Fernandez shares a key lesson that he's taken on the journey to becoming Northern Europe MD at HRS Group. Louis, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks very much for having me, Dave. Delighted to be here.
So what's made you the brilliant B2B marketer that you are today, Louis?
Oh, clearly it's just luck, right? No, I'm joking. It's actually a lot of hard work, but also I think a question of seizing opportunities when they're presented to you. And actually making the most of those opportunities, as well as then I've been very fortunate to be working with great people around you. It's one of these things that I've learned a long time ago, you're only ever as good as the team that you work with. And I think surrounding yourself with brilliant people is absolutely key to progressing as a marketer, and knowing where that talent is and when to spot that talent and bring it on board. It's kind of interesting. I remember when I was being interviewed for a role at Hewlett-Packard Enterprise, there was a question that came up, and I answered the question by saying, you know, if I go into a meeting room and I'm the smartest person in the meeting, then I'm probably in the wrong meeting. And that's very true, because, you know, I think as a leader, what you want to do is have great people around you so that they can tell you what to do. I think it was Steve Jobs that said that, wasn't it? You don't hire great people and tell them what to do. You hire great people and hope they tell you what to do. Yeah. And that's very much the mantra that I've worked to and been fortunate enough to do that.
So surrounding yourself with great people, is that something that you do in a kind of premeditated, strategic way? You kind of, I don't know, you think about what skills you need and then go out and make best buddies with that sort of person, or is it kind of a bit more reactive than that? How do you go about it?
I'd love to say there was some sort of Machiavellian sort of grid that I used to be able to decide, you know, these are the people that I need on my team, but unfortunately it's not quite like that. I think it's you know, during an interview process you will get a feel, I think, for an individual, how they think. And it's the way that people think that I think is important. What I don't want is, I don't want clones of myself. I want people that think differently, you know, because if I don't then have somebody that's prepared to challenge me in my point of view, then actually that's not a good use of that person's intellect. I need somebody to come to me and say, actually, I don't agree with you for these reasons. So I think I'm looking for people when I interview people that are prepared to challenge, because I think that's a really valuable skill. That's the first thing. The second thing I think I look for is attitude. And by that, I mean, it's the right attitude for why somebody would want to do something. They don't have to have the full skill set. But what they have to have is they have that willingness to learn, that willingness to participate, that willingness to be present, to you know, have that passion. That for me is much more important, I think. So I think, whilst I say there is no Machiavellian sort of grid that I use, I think as a mental model for when I'm recruiting people, that's what I look for. And certainly within the teams that I have, though, it's the attitude of the individuals within those teams that you work with that really can either make or break the team. And I think that's really, really important. So again, I've gone out of my way, whether it's consciously or subconsciously, to sort of surround myself with people that have, you know, that real capacity to learn, the capacity to think differently, and the drive to make things happen.
So I'm going to really press on the Machiavellian or not nature of Mr. Fernandez now. So you categorize attitude when you're looking at recruiting an individual, but how much then do you try to foster that attitude through the team culture that you go on to create?
A lot. I mean, it's one of these things. I think, you know, you have to, as a leader, be open, and it's not just about talking about being open, it's about acting like you're open. You know, it's everything you do, your behaviors have to mirror what you talk about. And if the, and there's two ways that happens, either you're trying to do that and it doesn't come naturally, in which case, you know, people can, for want of a better term, smell it a mile off, or it's just how you are as an individual. And I think the thing is, you know, again, it goes on to how you interact with folks. Do you have a belief that, you know, all people are inherently lazy and, you know, you have to effectively beat them into a way of working, one school? Or is it that actually you start off with this belief that actually everybody comes to work in the morning, do they not, wanting to do a good job? You know, they want to give the best of themselves every day, and you give them that level of trust to be able to go on and do brilliant jobs. And I thankfully fall into that latter camp. And I've been fortunate enough that that's been rewarded to me personally by actually giving trust. People then take that trust and run with it.
And I wonder if this works the other way around as well. So do you govern your career choices by what you can personally add to an organization and the difference that you bring?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting, this question, actually. I think of it in terms of hygiene factors and motivators. And, you know, when you are looking at a career move, yes, there are certain hygiene factors that you will look at, whether it's salary, terms and conditions, those kind of things. And that's great. And so long as it satisfies those criterion, you can move on. It's the motivators that are really important. What is the size of the challenge? How much is it going to test me personally? How much am I going to be challenged on a day-to-day basis? How much influence will I have to be able to change what we do in a, for the positive? That is what really excites. And that again goes a little bit back to attitude, because I think, you know, if you approach it in terms of how can I effect change for the good, you know, that's the real motivator for me. And I think, again, it does change depending on where you are in terms of life stage and career stage as well, because I think, you know, earlier on in your career, you know, you maybe have this real passion for X or Y or Z, and you want to do something, and you have a dream that you're pursuing, and there's that, and you go after that, and it's not about money, it's about, you know, the conditions that you're in and so on and so forth. Then maybe you move on a little bit in life stage, and the reality of, you know, you become a homeowner, you get married, maybe you have kids, and suddenly you've got bills, right? And with bills to pay, suddenly the emphasis is maybe somewhere else. And then if you're fortunate enough to get to a position whereby actually you're able to then think more about, and I find myself doing this increasingly, thinking about legacy. You know, what can I leave behind in an organization I've been in? What, you know, how positive is it likely to be for other people after I've left? Mm-hmm. What's that legacy going to be like? And I think it's about having that positive impact. You know, and I think that's kind of what I look for, certainly.
Louis Fernandez, Managing Director of Northern Europe at HRS Group, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure to be here.
And that's all for this episode of the Business Marketing Club podcast. Thanks to my guests, Ali Richards, Jonathan Kahn, Rachel Hind-Harris and Louis Fernandez. Please do let us know what you thought of today's podcast. Give us a rating or a review where your pod service allows it. And if you've got something interesting, practical and visionary to share with our listeners, why not volunteer to be a guest on a future podcast? If you've enjoyed the podcast, look out for other webinars, training, blogs and mentoring services run by our not-for-profit community network, the BMC. There's more than 1,000 participants involved at the time of recording, and we'd love for you to come on board as well. Find out more at businessmarketingclub.org.uk or send me your comments and feedback about the BMC at davestevensnow@gmail.com. I hope to see you again. I'm Dave Stevens. Thanks for listening.